another episode of the Geek Whisperers. I'm Amy Lewis.
I'm Matt Brender.
And I'm John Mark Troyer.
And we are here with a very special guest this week. Welcome, Andy Warfield.
Hi, I'm Andy Warfield.
Well, tell our listeners, for the one listener who might not know who you are, can you tell them who you are and what you're up to these days?
Sure. I'm Andy. I guess I'm the CTO, one of the founders, most recently of a company called Coho Data. I'm also a prof at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, where I live. And I've been in technology for a few decades at this point.
Great. That is quite a something. What has kept you in technology, do you think, for a few decades?
I don't know.
I like to stump people right off the bat.
straight into the sort of life purpose question.
Why are you here? What is it all for?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
No, I'm having fun. And that's why I've done it all along.
Well, you have one of the classic stories of technology. I don't know it well yet, but I'm looking forward to learning it. It's a little bit of an oversimplification to call it the college dorm room startup motif. But you've got a little bit of that in terms of your past. Can you kind of take us into that story?
Yeah, there was no dorm room, though. So
man, you're ruining a perfectly good stereotype.
Okay, we know. It was a garage.
Yeah, I have to deflate the startup by like 10 years of academic rambling rather than the college dorm room thing. So I did do a university startup. The startup was around the work that we did with the Zen Hypervisor, which was, you know, super educational for me in lots of ways. But the sort of college dorm room end of that didn't actually start until I was a PhD student living in the UK at the University of Cambridge. And so prior to that, I'd done an undergrad in Ontario. I'd done my master's in BC, and then finally, I guess I'd worked for about a year each at Nortel as a developer, and then at AT&T Research as a member of the technical staff, and then finally went to Cambridge to do PhD, and that was when we did the Zen stuff, and that turned into a startup. So it wasn't the sort of super fast one.
Yeah, and I do kind of want to jump in because I think that I wonder if some people get disheartened with this concept of they're going to be in their, you know, first like undergraduate college dorm room and have this lightning idea. I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting, like you said, that this was your path, right? That you had been around the academic block a little bit, and this came to you at a time where you had you know, some foundation, basically.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I mean, even reflecting on the startup end of that thing, and I would love to get this bit of story from the other guys that were involved in Zen and ZenSource in the early days, and that I'm sure it would be, you know, slightly or significantly different from all of us. But my memory, at least, is that we didn't talk an awful lot about doing a startup with that through most of the initial work, right? We wanted to write some papers, and we were really enjoying building the hypervisor. And we pushed it into open source, and we were super surprised at the amount of traction that project ended up getting in open source. It was sort of a weird thing in developing a big sort of, you know, researchy operating systems project, that it turned out that a whole bunch of industrial people, right, Intel and HP and IBM and others, had these like secret skunkworks hypervisor projects that they weren't sharing. And there'll be Switzerland of hypervisors, right? That suddenly there are all these people that could contribute and stuff. And that ended up being like a really, really exciting and educational thing about not just writing code and open source, but working with the community and, you know, working with a really large software project. And it was relatively late in the work on that somebody said, hey, maybe we should try and do a startup around this thing. So,
So
sort of a weird twist.
So you didn't have the intention as you're researching this to productize it? It really was just for the sort of for the fun of figuring it out?
It was. We wrote a bunch of really really interesting papers, right, on that thing, and we're all systems researchers. So, you know, we wrote Zen, We had the original Zen paper at the it's kind of like the high end of systems conferences. It's this conference called SOSP that everybody that's an academic systems researcher sort of strives for as a publication venue. And then we, you know, once we had that thing done, in addition to the sort of open source traction, we did a bunch of cool things with the hypervisor. So, you know, we wrote a paper about the first implementation of live migration. And we did a bunch of cool stuff with protecting device drivers and things like that. It was really just, you know, a really, really great toy and a really, really like technically incredible team to work with. And I guess maybe it's, you know, partially to do with some of the stuff that we talked about earlier. I was an undergrad during the first .com, you know, period. And so I guess I got a lot of my, you know, wondering about one day doing a startup, you know, sweat out of me by the time that I was kind of at Cambridge. I was sort of resigned to doing research at that point.
What did make you pull the switch to jump over?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think we were really enjoying with Zen, you know, becoming mature enough that other people were running it in production, and talking to not just the sort of like Amazons and Rackspaces of the world, but some of the other customers, like customers of the open source project. That's my new, I guess, nouns around talking to things from Co. But, you know, the other participants in the community and stuff using stuff, that it was really cool to see it being used in anger. And so I think the idea of standing up a company and trying to like really complete it to the point that it was a packaged product struck us as like a fun challenge. And that was a great experience to go through.
Question there. So I find this all fascinating because having been through university certainly doesn't prepare one necessarily to jump out and start a business. How did you go about doing that? Was it, like you said, there were a group of people involved?
You know, one thing that I've really felt throughout my career is that there's inside academics, right, especially in computer systems, where people get, you know, job offers from Google and Facebook, you know, five times a day. There's a lot of question as to the merits of the sort of research degree, right? The sort of like, should I do a PhD? Should I do a master's even path? And, you know, one of the arguments that I hear people make all the time is you're going to get to go work on really interesting people with technically great people, really interesting systems with technically great people, no matter what. You know, that's maybe not what you should do it for. And I think that that's true. I think the bit that was actually really valuable for me in the research position as a student was it's a lot of responsibility and a lot of responsibility to be sort of creative and determined in that role, right? You're sort of on your own to figure out the topic of research that you can persevere with, to figure out how to like describe it and get other people excited about it, to figure out how to get other students to even work with you on things, because most good projects tend to happen as a group, and to like, you know, even in the face of it being incredibly tedious, you know, do the finishing work to measure it and get it shipped. And a lot of those lessons, you know, from the social stuff around working with people to the presentation skills around writing it up and presenting it to, you know, just the whole thing actually ends up being a set of skills that I have found to be incredibly useful in working in startups, working in businesses generally.
I find that fascinating just because, again, certainly not the debate we're having here, and I think there's so many ways to go, but you often hear that debate of, you know, should people go to university at all? Do people have good ideas and drop out? Again, that college dorm room idea. I love your story in that there's many different ways and that you came away with these very practical lessons that did prepare you for what you were doing next. So I just think that's an interesting one to highlight that.
Yeah. So now let me say the opposite thing, which is that, you know, it was great to get all that stuff. When we started ZenSource, I think, you know, I don't have a list of all the mistakes you can make, but you know, I'm not sure if we ticked off all the boxes, but you know, we ticked off a lot of them. I think you know, we staffed the engineering team with a pile of people with PhDs who were all confident that they were the smartest person in the room, and we spent easily as much time arguing with each other about, you know, which type-safe language to work with, or you know, whatever other topic there was of the day, as we did actually building stuff.
All thought, and so, no, you know, action.
Exactly, spectacular fights. We, you know, we all lived in the UK at the time, but we started an office in Silicon Valley and hired a bunch of people out there. And you know, we basically said, you know, we'll give you guys some good ideas, and you just go build it. And those poor guys, you know, did not have the sort of collaboration that I think they might have hoped for in joining a startup. You know, there were just lots of bumps along the buildup of that company. There was loads of stuff to learn as we did that. And I don't think that anything prepares you for those lessons in terms of building a startup than you know, doing them wrong and realizing in retrospect that you have.
And that takes one of my very favorite questions of asking people what they would never do again. And you came prepared with, you're like, let me start at A and work my way through. Now, again, I appreciate the candor. Do you, where it, for people who are having trouble getting over that hump and just getting out there and trying, you know, be they success or failure, what would you say to them?
I'd say, yeah, go to graduate school. You'll get lots of experience failing to do things that you think. I don't know. I think this is a thing that I see with myself, and you know, I've had this with grad students, with people in the company. You know, I think it is so easy to fixate, and you know, you see this with especially like growth things, which is true in the relatively short time that you're in a research degree or in a startup, that it's easy to see all the stuff that is hard and that is struggle. And it's often hard to see the stuff that you fixed even over the past 2 weeks, right? Like one of the things that I've really found that I've tried to do in terms of the current startup is to try to write down, you know, stuff that I'm trying to fix, right? And revisit those lists, you know, and I make this sound like I'm much more organized than I am, but, you know, once every few months and go and look at where I was like a few months ago and actually remind, you know, everybody on the engineering team, especially, you know, how much we've solved. Because it's very easy to see the challenges, right? The fact that, you know, everything takes longer to build than you think it will, and you know, you're always not happy with the state of the stuff that you have, and you always want it to be better. And unless you're looking at the stuff that you've achieved, it's easy to decide not to try new stuff or things like that. So I think, you know, I think tracking change is just as important as trying new stuff on.
One important lesson to glean there for anyone in any state in their career, honestly, I think if you're the closer you are to technology, the more you're just looking at your roadmap and what bugs are coming in and trying to mitigate them while building new products. It's a nice sobering reminder that we've actually achieved a lot along the way, and taking those little moments for small victories are, I don't know, that's a learned art. What made you learn that, or how do you do that? Either one of those, Andy.
Maybe I feel like I'm pinning all of my learnings on grad students and working with them, but I've spent, like, you know, I guess half of my career on that side of things. When I moved to a professor position after finishing PhD, and I was really supervising, you know, these like, you know, 8 year younger versions of myself. I remembered exactly how harrowing it was to, you know, to try and pick a research problem even. But certainly to have things that you thought were going to work out not work out. And one thing that I found really successful was to encourage those students to keep track, right, more carefully about what they had tried and what had succeeded and what had failed. And I guess maybe some of that stuff started to rub off on me a bit. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think it does. I mean, Matt, grad school is a horrible, horrible existence, speaking from my experience. I mean, it's a really long slog, and you know, like Andy says, you're never quite sure where the end is or how far you are along, and you know, a lot of things don't work. So in that sense, I can definitely see it as a good parallel track. But in the meantime, your friends that went right into industry, you know, and got good jobs, you know, they're all of a sudden, you know, senior managers, and they have great salaries, and you're this crappy grad student eating ramen and, you know, not quite sure when you're ever going to get your degree. So it is a journey, I'll say.
It's totally true.
Or well, eating English and breakfasts that are cheap.
No, you can't afford English breakfast if you're
That's 2 days worth of food. So a great question, sort of segueing us in of, Andy, you mentioned, you know, you've been on both sides of this fence of, you've got the academic side and the industry side. Having gone back and forth, what pulls you? What's the lure on each side of that? What do you think? Do you feel an even split? Do you feel a stronger pull? Talk to us a little bit about that.
I don't know. Yeah, it's a fun question. I don't know. I think I'm still, you know, early enough in my career that I don't know what the long-term answer is, right? Sometime around the time I retire, I'll figure that one out. But the thing that I found back and forth, so I did my undergrad, and then I went and I worked for a little over a year at Nortel writing optical switching software. And then I went back and I did my master's, and then I found a position at AT&T's research lab and went off and did systems research on big, fast media systems there. And then I went back to grad school again. I went to Cambridge and did the PhD there. And then we did the startup. And then I went back and was a prof. And then I went back to doing this startup. Every time that I've stayed on one side of that fence, I've been, you know, I've convinced myself that I wanted to be on the other one. And so, you know, that said, every time that I've stayed on one side of it very long, right, I kind of feel it, right? Like the move from working on stuff at Cambridge and open source and for a PhD, right? The I could move really fast. I could build really cool stuff because I didn't have the obligation to have it work for, you know, any longer than it took to make a graph for a paper. Right, and I make that sound like much worse than it is. I think the stuff that I wrote was actually pretty good by and large, but you know, that's kind of where the bar is for those things. You're not obligated to release your code, although I've always tried to. And so it was really exciting to go and actually, you know, work with a team more collaboratively and to build stuff that actually shipped and that people used. Right, I really enjoyed that. And when I went back to being a prof after working on ZenSource for I guess like 6 years or so, Citrix at the end and building an office and building a team, I had all these ideas of things that we could never get done on product cycles, right? Like there's always so much to do in terms of what needs to happen next and what the field is asking for and stuff. That it was really exciting. So when I went back, you know, one of the first things I did with students at UBC was to build, like, take some of the ideas around live VM migration and make them run so quickly and so continuously that we could do failover with them, right? And so we built a system that at the time, you know, did a lot of the stuff that UC VM are doing with their fault-tolerant implementation today. And, you know, I didn't have to finish that nearly to the level of completeness and robustness that VMware's system works. But with a couple of grad students, we were able to build the really interesting parts of it and talk about it. It was really fun to do. Mm. And so, you know, I don't think that one side's better than the other, right? And I've definitely found in this latest thing, right, building out Coho, it sort of seems to be, at least for the moment, letting me do both, right? I'm still supervising some students at UBC, but even within Coho, we're managing to write some papers. We're working with, you know, really, really early technology, some of which is stuff that, you know, vendors are providing us ahead of general availability. And we're building systems, you know, that are really on that edge between research and production, and I find that absolutely, like, delightful and super challenging.
Well, I love that you just gave us the functional definition too of a technology book versus street.
Well, there's also an open source versus non-open source component here. I mean, Zen, obviously open source, that ZenSource had a lot of that. Coho actually sells hardware and software and probably uses open source. I don't know, Andy, is there any parallel there in terms of the open source versus closed? Obviously, you've chosen not to be a lifelong open source zealot, but was there any consideration of that as you were starting Coho?
Well, so on the starting Coho thing, you know, certainly with running a bunch of this comes down to pragmatic stuff, right? Like, you know, running a traditional, you know, Valley venture funded startup, right? Like, even you mentioned the fact that we sell hardware, right? We don't build hardware. We sell a packaged hardware appliance, and that's a form factor that, you know, has a business model behind it that makes the company viable, right? We spent a whole bunch of time early on trying to figure out whether we could build a storage company only selling software. And at the time, at least, there wasn't a clear path, right? The amount of volume that we were going to have to do at the time was looking pretty scary in terms of what the company would have to achieve to be successful. And so, you know, a bunch of that decision has nothing to do with any kind of you know, philosophical stuff about open versus closed. It's really just pragmatics. I've loved working with open source software. We try to open source everything that I do on the UBC side of things very aggressively.
When it comes to research related to fields of computer science, do you think the best products come from academic research, or do you think that there's just every once in a while you'll have an academic research paper that makes great sense as a business venture?
I do. I'm super biased on this, of course, but no,
good.
I think
that's why you're invited.
I think a lot of, in terms of like really interesting ideas, right? Getting back to, I guess, the grad school point, you know, if you take a smart and creative person and you deprive them of all other stimulus and ask them to come up with a, you know, something to work on for a few years and force them to read every other attempt that anyone else has made at solving a given problem, right? They generally come up with some interesting stuff. And so, you know, that kind of like thorough exploration of ideas, especially given the kind of, you know, creative people that tend to self-select for that in the first place, I think it leads to like great stuff, right? And especially in well-run systems teams where you have groups of people working together and talking about stuff, you know, you see stuff like, you know, the Berkeley Rad Lab, for example, with like, you know, I don't know how many, 17,000 startups in the past few years, right? Like the Cambridge stuff when I was there around Zen, a whole bunch of those people are in, you know, startup ecosystem stuff, not just us, but the Bromium guys and so on. There's lots of great opportunity to pull those ideas out into product stuff. I think, you know, when you are in a product environment, it's often difficult to, and it's not your fault. It's kind of just the nature of especially mature large company products. It's often difficult to see the forest through the trees, right? You're busy, you're trying to get stuff done, and you know the view that you have is necessarily fairly specific to the stuff that you're working on.
Where do you think we'll continue to see innovation come from? Do you think it comes from both the industry and the academic side? I know we were sort of talking around that a little bit, or do you think one side has a distinct advantage?
Because I think they're totally complementary.
Interesting.
You know, like I said, there's not a lot of motivation for the academic researcher to really, really finish and polish work, right? Like, you know, a high bar for a lot of systems research, for example, is actually releasing the code and you know, having other people be able to compile it, right? That, you know, the bar increasingly is successful open source project, but you certainly don't want to hold up somebody's graduation on getting that. Whereas product companies are motivated exactly off of building stuff that you know, is reliable and easy to use. I think one of the challenges, going back to the earlier question about the open source stuff, is open source kind of weirdly sits in between those two things, right? That, you know, you in many open source environments have, you know, enthusiastic, but basically hobbyists. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but people who are enthusiastic but have to get some other way working on projects. And so they naturally gravitate toward the technically interesting bits of things rather than the boring fit and finish ends of things that you really need, you know, to ship product. And like, that's a thing that continues to be, you know, a struggle for open source companies. And for open source projects generally.
I think that's a really interesting observation, and it makes a lot of sense. And thank goodness we have people drawn to sort of all aspects of the work cycle for sure. Which actually leads me into my next question. I think it's interesting. Another trend I see here is you talk about your life as both a professor, but also CTO of a company. You're in a leadership role in both regards. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that is, what life as a leader is like in the technical world?
I don't know. It's super fun. I enjoy both sides of it immensely. The academic side of things, is very creative. And you know, especially working with largely unafraid students, or rather maybe terrified students who are unafraid of telling you that they think you're full of BS, is very refreshing and grounding. Working with the company, it's a wild ride, right? The leadership role here, I mean, we're currently a little over 100 people in the company, and we've been around for just over 3 years. And so, you know, this job has been completely different every year than it was the year before. And you know, every month there is a different exciting problem to go through. So, you know, I have young kids. I have three young kids. They're almost 3, 5, and 8. And one of the things across all of that stuff that I've been absolutely ruthless about is trying to get home in the evening in time to turn off my phone as frequently as I can remember to do it and hang out with them until they go to sleep. And so, you know, that's sort of a thing that I guess as a leader, on both sides, I've tried to really emphasize, right, that for our engineering team and for my students and stuff, there's lots more than the work, and I try and, you know, at least model that much.
Wow, that's really good to hear, especially when there's just so many stories of terrible burnout, especially in startup culture. It's good to hear you reinforcing that and, you know, leading by example as well. I'm curious. So I've seen in Coho's recent marketing that, you know, Andy, the CTO, is not just the tech guy behind closed doors, but I've had the fortune of seeing you speak at V Brown Bags and at other events, and I'm reading your blog posts on the website. It seems like you're very much being positioned as a thought leader, dare I say that term. It's kind of interesting as a technical person that's being positioned as a vocal public figure. How do you enjoy the balance of those as related to your job?
So I'm laughing only at the idea that we're consciously like positioning me as that. I don't know that. I think our poor marketing people, are happier to have me stand up and go into the weeds technically than to have to stand up and do it by trying to remember what I went through. I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges for us in terms of, like, I'll come back to the thing you actually asked, but one of the big questions or big challenges for us as a company is that, you know, I'm from like a pretty deep technical background, and the stuff that I want us to build, right, is really efficient systems, right? So I really care about getting, you know, good utilization off of the CPU and the flash and building systems that are, you know, aesthetically pleasing. And that often needs a much deeper explanation than is typically done in a lot of, you know, product marketing. And so, you know, our marketing team has suffered, you know, my insistence on that very well, but it's often, you know, been by going, fine, you go do it. And so, So that's, I mean, that's the degree to which it's being positioned by them. I love talking about this stuff. You know, I love writing about it. I think, you know, that definitely comes out of the academic background, but I really love building, you know, big systems. And the great thing with the startup is, you know, with an engineering team of, you know, around 60 people at this point, you know, we really can build big systems. And so, you know, it's exciting for me to be able to come in and you know, spend time with various teams who are all doing like really, really challenging stuff, and then go out and try and explain that stuff to people. And so, you know, that's probably to me been, you know, the singularly most enjoyable bit of doing this particular startup is, you know, almost an educational end of things, right? Just being able to talk about it.
So the leadership role, do you think that, was that something did you fall into that, or was that intentional? Is that sort of something you can't help, always been who you are? Or, you know, when you look back, did you always want to be a CTO when you grew up? or is that something that happened?
No, it definitely did not enter into my planning early on. No, I mostly I think my career has kind of been more problem focused, right? Like I've enjoyed, you know, going from interesting technical, you know, thing to thing. And that in this case, right, I guess maybe I got to a point of maturity in my career where I was comfortable, you know, working with a team on something and not necessarily, you know, having the ability to, you know, hack on it on a daily basis. But still feel, you know, some degree of deep involvement and ownership of bits of it. And so, you know, when I realized that I could do that, and that, you know, when we found a problem that was big enough that we could kind of chase this way, it worked out to be a good opportunity. It's really enjoyable. But I can't claim that I planned it all along at all.
So Andy, as a technical leader and as a leader of graduate students,
yeah,
what advice do you give or not give to people in your orgs, you know, about managing their careers and about where they should be looking? And is there a different advice that you give to grad students versus members of your technical staff at the company?
No, that's a great question. So, I mean, I guess one thing in terms of like, and in some ways this is more of a possibly operational management question than necessarily a leadership question. But, you know, one thing that I do absolutely suggest, and I have a conversation about this, you know, in the first talk with new employees that we hire often before we make an offer. And I often also have this talk very early with graduate students and periodically through, you know, a sort of leadership or management, as, you know, for them, you know, the paths are typically they go work for Google, they go become a prof somewhere, or they go start a company. And the point that I always try to make to my grad students is that, you know, I can help with all three of those paths, right? That's my job. But I can only help insofar as they know which one they want to do. And it's okay not to know, but, you know, we're going to make slow progress toward all of them. And once they figure out which way they want to go, right, that's a point at which, you know, we can try to set the direction right on things. And the same thing is true, you know, in terms of the staff in an engineering organization, right? There are people who want to take a leadership path. There are people who want to lead technically, but really be in a more individual contributor. And, you know, there are especially in, you know, relatively early companies where you get, you know, earlier career people, there are people who are still learning which of those two things they want. And the best thing to do is to give them the opportunities to learn, you know, whether or not they're going to be great at a thing, and also give them the opportunity to change their mind. And so, you know, in all this stuff, that's kind of the path that I've always tried to take with things is to, you know, encourage people to think about what they want to get and back them up as much as I possibly can in terms of getting there.
All right. I've got my question. I'm going to slightly rephrase it.
Is this the part where I'm going to start crying?
Yes. Yes. So I always like to ask people what advice they would give someone to never, ever do again. But I feel like you've given us a lead in for that
another place.
Yeah. But so to sort of follow on John's question, have you ever found yourself counseling someone in academics to go into industry or vice versa? Do you find yourself, having been on both sides of that fence, do you find yourself traffic cop directing people back and forth between the worlds because you can see they would be a better fit on one side or the other?
Yeah, I guess I don't know how much anyone ever listens to me, but yeah, I've definitely been in lots of those conversations. I mean, there are a few concrete examples. I mean, one thing that's maybe a little bit different actually between Canada and the U.S. in terms of the way grad school works is in the U.S. you tend to go straight into a PhD from an undergrad degree, right? And so you kind of make this big commitment, but lots of people don't finish PhDs, right? In Canada, there's a separation. So at UBC, for example, you know, we accept students to do a research master's where they get to do a little bit of research in some courses and then graduate, and then elect whether or not to come on for PhD. And there were a few situations in there where I worked with students and the students honestly weren't sure, right? Like they liked the research environment, but you know, there's a loneliness and a sort of a level of commitment involved in doing PhD. And so, you know, we said up front, let's try it out, right? I'm comfortable signing on to supervise you or to have you in the lab. But, you know, we're going to put something in the calendar for a year from now to decide whether or not it's working out and whether or not you want to stay. And interestingly, in most of those cases, right, in fact, probably in all of the cases where I've done that, the student ended up not staying. Right, but I think that's still super valuable to both of us. Right, we had a concrete opportunity for them to do a check, and you know they got to convince themselves that it wasn't for them, which is maybe better than you know always wondering. And so
you've brought the 90-day trial software model.
I've brought the freemium model to graduate.
Freemium PhD. Yeah,
I'll be starting my own institution very shortly. On the other side, I mean, I'm always, you know, fighting the urge to tell, you know, staff in the company that they should do PhDs. It doesn't serve us well for me to make those pitches. So I try to sit on my hands.
That's really interesting. So you there is temptation there.
Yeah, I felt pretty fried after my PhD, frankly.
So did
there's
I.
Just more of a flash fry feeling than a sous vide.
And I've been tempted to get one since I graduated, but I just keep getting jobs because they're fun and pay me a lot more than a PhD program would.
So secretly, Andy, we just brought you on here to break the tie there so we could help Matt figure out what to do next.
Yeah, four or against a PhD for me.
And I'm happy to announce that Matt's actually going to be joining me as a student in the fall. we'll be writing type-safe multidimensional key-value stores, the next generation.
Oh, that's so great.
I think John's in, too.
I'm totally into it. Let's do it.
Well, Andy, this has been really fantastic. We appreciate you taking the time with your many, many hats that you wear and especially needing to keep that work-life balance and get home to the very important next gen. So when you aren't doing one of these many things, where can people find you online?
Oh, they can probably find me on Twitter at Andy Warfield. But this was super fun. Thanks very much for having me on the podcast.
Absolutely. We had a great time having you here. A very different look, and we've never taken the academic look at technology, so we really appreciate you sharing your insights.
Super. Thank you.
And until next time, everybody out there, don't make it an academic practice. If you like the Geek Whispers, give us some likes, some stars, tell a friend, tell a neighbor, tell it to your graduate class. Just a hint. And until next time, this is the Geek Whispers.
You've been listening to the Geek Whispers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whispers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as J. Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.
Your pun was so subtle this time. You always sneak one in, Amy, but that was about as blatant as they get.
That was good. Are you stable, though, Andy? Are you able to?
Do you mean, like, for this talk? Or...
For, yeah.
It's a fairly open question.
Hello, is it me? That's the easy one. That's my go-to.
I feel like there's going to be yodeling before we start.
Please let there be yodeling. If anybody here can yodel. All right, are we ready?
Yodel-a-hee-hoo.
We are rolling.
Okay. Well, that was unfortunate.